So welcome, everybody. This is Lunchtime Learning. These are for, if you're new to the system, we do these about once a month on various topics that are popular in financial education. Today we're going to talk about mobile finance, and really we're going to talk about one big survey of mobile finance that the Federal Reserve did, but I think it has lots of really interesting implications for our work. I will talk for probably about a half an hour or so. I welcome questions as we go along. I know it's hard to chime in a call like this, but I will stop at some point and look for your questions and any comments or feedback or ideas you have regarding how this work might affect you and your work and your ideas about how you approach financial education. The materials that I'm going to be talking about today are on the website fyi.uwex.edu/financial series. And so there is a PDF file there, a brief 2014-2 on the emergence of mobile finance, what it means for you and your community. There's also a link on that website to a report from the Federal Reserve that summarizes the data I'll be talking about in much more detail. So if you want the extended version, you can always look at that report, which the link again is on the FYI site to the Federal Reserve version of these data. So with that, I will get going and start talking about this topic and go over the brief that's been posted. And again, if folks have questions or comments along the way, I welcome that, but I will pause at the end so that everybody gets a chance to chime in as well. So this topic of mobile finance, depending on your perspective, is either really, really big and really important, or kind of a quaint side issue and not really that important. And I think that really, for a lot of us, it depends upon what our experience has been. You know, I think somebody said if your kids are doing things on their phones, that's kind of cute and quaint. If your parents are doing things on their phones, that's kind of cute and quaint. But, you know, when your grandparents start doing things on their phones, then you know it's getting serious. And, you know, we're starting to see a greater and greater proliferation of mobile technology. And by that I mean cell phones. I mean mobile devices like smartphones. I mean iPads. I mean the Nexus 7. I mean all kinds of tablets, Kindles and Kindle Fires, all these different tablets that are out there right now. And so it's not just cell phones per se, but the broader set of technological devices that people use to get on the internet, to engage with other people, and to engage with financial institutions. And so these are all versions of what we might consider to be mobile finance. In the Federal Reserve's report, which I'll talk about more in a minute, they sort of distinguish between you know, what might be considered mobile banking versus mobile payments. You know, and there's different ways we can think about financial management tools that might be available in a mobile way. In some ways, these are artificial distinctions because people use their mobile technologies for all kinds of different things. Sometimes it's just to check account balances. Sometimes it's to transfer money to a babysitter. Sometimes it's to actually move money from one account to another. So there are lots of different things that people do, and it's hard to classify anybody as, well, I'm just an account balance checker, because you might be today, but in a month from now, you might start to do more with your phone. So I'm going to talk about this set of topics sort of together, not discriminating a whole lot, although I will get into some specific issues for people who are unbanked or for people who are on public benefits or even just the use of phones in the shopping experience, all of which are probably relevant as we think about the kinds of people that we're doing family financial education around. So any questions before I dig deeper into this topic? All right. So one thing that you probably know is that more and more personal finance is an electronic activity. If you look at other countries, the paper check is really non-existent. You know, many Scandinavian countries and European countries, people haven't seen checks in 10 years. Almost nobody goes to a brick and mortar brick and mortar bank branch, and as a result, the hours of a brick and mortar bank branch are just a few hours a day in some places. So more and more what people do in terms of their quote unquote banking or their use of the financial institution is on the computer, on the phone, or online. It's not a face-to-face activity the way it was, say, 20 years ago. And in the United States, we have moved quickly away from paper checks. We're probably way behind most developed countries in that there are still a lot of paper checks. There's still millions of paper checks that are circulated, in the economy today. But even those paper checks are converted to electronic checks pretty quickly. As soon as you go to your bank, they scan it. It becomes an electronic document, and the paper check is no longer moving around the system. In the United States, it's been over 10 years. The majority of financial payments are actually automated. So it's automated clearinghouse, or ACH is the acronym that's used in the industry, where, you know, payments are taking place electronically and not in some sort of paper form. For consumers, that could mean the method of payment where I write down my bank account number and my bank routing number. And so you might do this when you have an automatic payment somewhere where they set up an automatic ACH from the bank account. But if you think about it, there's probably lots of other ways that you do electronic payments, whether that's a credit card, debit card, you know, different kinds of payments that you might set up on a other kind of account other than the bank account that are still transactions. And ultimately, you may pay those credit card bills with an ACH as well. So, you know, oftentimes what we're doing is largely technologically driven and largely remote. You know, for several decades, people have been doing this on the telephone, and for at least a decade, people have been doing it on their home computer. All the thing that's really changed is now we've introduced a new device, a smaller device that you can put in your pocket, and that you can access lots of different places on cellular networks or on Wi-Fi networks. And as the use of those devices is expanded and the prevalence of those networks is expanded, more and more people are gravitating from, instead of, you know, calling on a landline or calling on their cell phone, they're just doing the transaction on their smartphone or on their tablet. And these can be lots of different things. So, like I said before, it could be checking account balances, it could be paying bills, it could be moving money from one account to another, it could be doing a transaction where I'm actually payment party to party payment, so from one private party to another private party. I want to pay my neighbor, or I want to reimburse somebody for tickets, I want to pay for Girl Scout cookies, something like that. So, you know, more and more we're using these devices to do these kinds of things. We broadly call this mobile banking, but mobile banking also includes, you know, other things, just like checking account balances or transferring from, say, checking to savings or savings to checking, paying off a bill, even a utility bill, which may not be at a bank institution, but you have to log in, tell them how much you want to pay. Maybe you put in a string of numbers for your account and routing number. Maybe you have a charge to a credit card. So more and more we see different kinds of payment structures that are set up that aren't necessarily even tied directly to your bank account. The other thing we see is the use of text messaging, where I may not actually do any transactions on my phone, but I have my credit card company or my bank send me a text message when my balance gets below some amount. You know, when the account goes below $500, send me a text message to alert me. Or when any transaction goes through the account greater than $2,000, send me a text message to alert me. So this is a very simple technology that any phone, really most phones today, can handle text messages. And so some people are just using it, that alert function, to sort of manage their account. What I think is interesting about this movement in the industry is that while more and more consumers are using these technologies to manage their personal finances, if you were to go through, I don't know, pick four or five financial curricula that are commonly used out there, the Money Smart or any other commonly used curriculum, you'll find very little mention of mobile technologies. Maybe a little bit about using the computer, but not as much about how to use your cell phone or those kinds of things. And it's important because it changes how we think about these things a little bit. I can check my account balance 15 times a day if I wanted to. I mean, if that was a useful thing, how often should I check my account balances? You know, we've oftentimes in financial education talked about looking at that annual, or not annual, I'm sorry, that monthly statement that comes in the mail. Well, oftentimes people are now paperless. There is no statement that comes in the mail. So how do we set up a system so that you might manage your money, how you monitor your accounts in an effective and organized way? How do we teach people to check their account balances frequently enough, but not too frequently, so that they are, you know, wasting their time or becoming fixated on particular transactions? And then it also raises a whole bunch of issues around safeguarding information. How do I make sure nobody else gets access to information I don't want them to see? And what do I do if I lose my phone? Or what do I do if I forget my password? How do I make sure that I don't use the same password for everything, so that if somebody accesses one of my accounts, they access all of my accounts? The other thing from a financial education standpoint, we need to help people understand is just because I'm able to click some buttons on my cell phone someday at 10 p.m. doesn't mean that the transaction occurred someday at 10 p.m. And how does mobile payment work? It may look like it's instantaneous. People understood when they wrote a check and put it in the mail, there was a delay, that you don't get credit for it as soon as it hits the mailbox. Helping consumers really understand that bill payment still is something they have to pay attention to. Waiting to the last minute may not count in terms of incurring late fees or those kinds of things. And the last thing is that there are a number of tools that are available to help people aggregate their accounts, to manage their balances, to manage due dates. So how do you use these online tools to your advantage, and what do they really mean in terms of helping you instead of becoming a barrier to account management? So these are all content areas that I could see, you know, at least a portion of financial education seminars talking about, but yet not much has been done. And so I don't have the solution to that problem. I don't have a curriculum in a box that you might like to see right now, but I think it helps us start to think about what needs to be developed and how we might begin to address these kinds of issues. So what I want to talk about for the rest of this call is one survey, well, actually two surveys, that the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, D.C. Put out, where they tracked consumer use of from a survey of mobile technologies in 2011 and again in 2012. And a subset of the people they asked questions of in 2011 were back in 2012. So we were able to see how things changed over time and what that means. This data is publicly available. The Federal Reserve did this as part of their consumer affairs unit at the board in Washington. Max Schmeiser, who used to be faculty here at Wisconsin in Madison, is now an economist at the Fed, and he and I have talked a lot about these data and shared much of the results that you'll see today with me, and so we thank him for that. So let me just talk quickly about the survey so you can understand of sort of what they were doing and why the survey might be useful for what we think about in our work. So again, they did this survey twice in 2011 and 2012 to try to get a sense of change over time. And they really made an effort to go after not just high-income people who have the latest and greatest iPhone, you know, that fits in their back pocket, but a broad set of consumers, including the unbanked and the underbanked, so people who did not have a conventional checking or savings account, or who sporadically had some form of transaction account, but also used other forms of alternative financial services, things like check cashers and payday lenders and other kinds of non-traditional bank or non-traditional financial transaction tools. And they did this in part because, you know, one of the motivations for this whole survey was to what extent does being banked mean anything anymore? Does it become more about being able to manage technology, to manage accounts through these mobile devices? And is there some substitution of banking in the traditional sense with these new technological devices? And so that's one of the reasons why they oversampled this population. So I think it has a lot of insights for the, you know, often the consumers that we think about for extension in financial education settings are people who are not heavy duty banking users if they're banked, and maybe are not thrilled about the kinds of quality of services they are, if they are banked and maybe on the verge of ditching their bank. And, you know, for them, these financial services that could be delivered by the smartphone or other technological platform might be a useful alternative. So, you know, one of the things that I oftentimes get some pushback around this topic is, well, you know, poor people don't have phones, or poor people don't have cell phones, or they don't have smartphones. And it's true that the use of a smartphone is much more likely for higher income populations. But by 2012, according to the Fed's data, about a third of people with incomes less than $40,000 had a smartphone. 80% had some kind of a cell phone or a mobile phone. And so this doesn't even count people who might have access to other kinds of technology tools other than a mobile device. So maybe they have a home computer, or they have tablets that they use on the Wi-Fi networks, that kind of thing. And this is obviously changing over time pretty quickly. So the use of smartphones really is growing. And the use of dumb phones, which I'm not sure is a real term, but I'm going to use it here anyway, for financial transactions is quite possible too, because of things like text messaging and other ways to manage accounts, even if you don't have an internet connected device. So it is pretty clear that this is changing rapidly. And in fact, I'll talk in the end about new data on the growth of smartphones. And it is a market that's expanding rapidly. And we've talked a lot about the digital divide in terms of internet access and computer access. In some ways, the mobile phone is a great equalizer because they work most places. There is the cost of buying one, but that cost has gone down dramatically. There is the cost of the monthly payment, but for a lot of people, they have to have some kind of communication device, whether that's a landline or whatever else. And so it doesn't cost that much more if you ditch the landline to just have a cell phone with a smartphone internet connectivity. So it is changing the rules and really bridging that digital divide in a lot of new ways that maybe we wouldn't have even anticipated 4 or 5 years ago. What's also interesting is in these data that the Fed collected, as many as half of people are using their phones for mobile banking type activities. The most common activity is oftentimes checking balances, but people are doing transactions. They're paying bills. They're using their phones for really the same kinds of things that maybe 10 years ago we would expect people to go into a bank branch or go into an institution and do. So there is definitely some substitution for these more bricks and mortar activities using the mobile phone. When they look specifically at the underbanked, people who have sort of limited banking, traditional checking or savings account, and the unbanked, people who don't have any, about 10% of their sample was unbanked or underbanked, it's about between 1 in 10 and 1 in 5 people, at least in this sample, who you would put in these categories of sort of underbanked or unbanked. So it's not common, but it certainly it's out there, and it may be more prevalent among the learners that you have in your workshops and the people that you're working with on a day-to-day basis. Many of them do have cell phones, and many of them do use their cell phone or smartphone for banking access type issues. So about 90% of the underbanked have access to a mobile phone, which is higher than the average for people with lower incomes, as we talked about before. And many of them are using these for making payments. Just under half are using them for making payments or transfers. And this seems to be growing over time. So we are definitely seeing some evidence. It's not strong, but some evidence that people who are maybe outside of the mainstream financial services market are turning more and more towards these technology solutions. Now, some of this is because the underbanked and unbanked tend to be younger and tend to be lower income, and they might have more comfort with these technological tools. But part of it too is that these tools are not very intimidating. If you're intimidated by going into a bank branch and dealing with people who you at least perceive as looking down at you, you know, there might be some real advantages to these technologies which are more remote and allow you to be a little bit more anonymous. So there might be some attraction to that. The other is just the convenience. I don't have to go anywhere. I don't have to be anywhere. I don't have to worry about banker's hours. You know, I can do these things on my time using these tools. So oftentimes, in terms of what we see people using their mobile phones for, you can see in Figure 2, the fully banked and the underbanked. Things like checking an account balance is most common. Using it to set up a low balance alert. These alerts are really common, especially among the underbanked. One of the things that people like about these text messages or even emails is they don't pay a lot of attention to when things are due and what balances might be. So this makes it easier for them to manage things. It gives them a reminder to manage their accounts more closely. Interestingly, the majority of people who are underbanked reported using their mobile devices for reducing spending. So they were actually using it to monitor how much they were spending. And again, these alerts, it's probably related to the alerts. You know, once I start to spend too much, I get an alert, and then I throttle back and start to pay more attention to those kinds of things. So we see maybe predictable in some ways how people are using these mobile devices, but some strong high percentages of the sample in some of these categories, which I think suggests that perhaps there's more prevalent use of these mobile devices than at least I would have predicted before I saw these survey data. The other thing that's important is that a lot of people who are using mobile devices for personal financial management right now have only recently begun to do it. So in the survey, they asked about the last 6 months. About 1 in 5 or 1 in 3 of the unbanked just started doing this in the last 6 months. So if this is new to you, that's okay. It's new to a lot of the learners and consumers that are out there too. It's sort of the development of new financial apps, of new tools that you can use on your phone or on your mobile device to manage your funds are increasing by the day. You know, I belong to a credit union here in Madison, and they just in the last year have rolled out a way to deposit checks by taking a picture of the check. That's a new technology. I had not seen that before, had to learn it before, so I've had to figure that out in the last 6 months or so. And that's a common experience that people are having in this market right now. So I think we should not be intimidated ourselves because the learners themselves are going through a learning curve as well. Another special subset of consumers that the Fed was interested in, I think we might be interested in too, are people who are getting public benefits. And as of March of last year, all federal benefits, unless you're over the age of 90, were supposed to be electronic deposits. The U.S. Treasury did this primarily because they saw the expense of having to print and mail paper checks every month for things like Social Security, for public benefits of different kinds. And many, if not all, states have now followed suit if they hadn't already gone to electronic. So even in Wisconsin, there are very few benefits at this point that are still paid by check. And many of the state departments in the state are not interested in issuing paper checks, and they want to do electronic transfers or ACH or payroll deposits and that kind of thing. So as a result of this shift at the federal level, people who were unbanked before, who perhaps were getting paper checks for public benefits, whether that's disability or Social Security, retirement, other kinds of benefits, had to figure out a solution. And so what Treasury did is issued a prepaid debit card. So this is a card that's reloadable. It acts in a lot of ways like a checking account. The card has deposits put on it every month for whatever the amount of the public assistance is or the benefit is. And you're allowed up to some number of withdrawals from a certain network of ATM machines, and you're allowed to use that machine for point of purchase sales. You can swipe it at a grocery store or someplace like that. And then you can also use it to do things like purchase money orders or, you know, the kinds of things at a conventional financial institution or at a retail check casher or even, you know, a Walmart or a Target or a place like that. So these cards have been pretty widely adopted, and there hasn't been a lot of press about the success of how Treasury rolled this card out, but it actually went amazingly smoothly. A lot of people thought that this was going to be a mess, that the unbanked, particularly people with disabilities, were never going to be able to get these cards and set up these cards and set up the PIN numbers and make them secure. And, you know, 98, I think, the last number I heard is like 98% of people who are unbanked and getting paper checks have transitioned over to this new system pretty seamlessly, and we haven't had a lot of problems with people, you know, having their benefits gobbled up by fees at this point. So it seems to have worked pretty well. So as a result, a lot of people who were previously in a cash-only economy and who are on public assistance now are getting a card that they use for most of their transactions, and they can reload that card, and they can use that card in new and different ways. And so this survey asked specifically about, you know, the use of these cards. One of the things about these cards is that you can check balances, you can watch spending, you can actually see every purchase you make using a mobile device or using a tablet or going online on a computer. And so these cards offer more services than just replacement of a check. They offer some other tools that people can use. And you can see that the use of the government public benefits card is not only restricted to the unbanked and underbanked, but also to the banked. That there's people who, for some reason or another, prefer to have their benefits put on a card instead of in their bank account. Maybe that's because of issues within a family where we want to keep funds segregated. Maybe that's people like the convenience of the card itself and how it works, and they, you know, they appreciate some of the features of it. I think that's instructive to us as well, that it's small, and we're only talking, you know, 5%, but it's growing over time. And so, you know, these cards actually seem to be playing some nice roles of being something in between a bricks and mortar bank account and also offering some of the aspects that the mobile payment systems use. Another aspect of these mobile technologies in finance is that you can use your smartphone, particularly, in a store. And you can do things like check out prices. Is this the best price for this item? You can use the check your balance and see if you have enough in your account to make this particular purchase or not, to do some on-the-fly budgeting or spending plan. And then we're beginning to see an increasing number of applications out there that are really designed to be your wallet, that the cell phone can be used to actually make a purchase, whether it's scanning at the checkout or it's, you know, there are some technologies right now where you can email somebody a payment through Square and some of these other companies that are out there right now, or where the phone itself can do an ACH transfer. So it goes to a third-party website and makes a transfer right there to the vendor. You see now in even public markets or, you know, different kinds of events, festivals, where you have vendors who are selling, you know, particularly it's crafts, I've seen this, where they have the Square attached to their phone and they'll scan your credit card right there and be able to make a charge. So we're seeing lots of features like this where the cell phone is really becoming the point of sale for the merchant and for the consumer in order to both do the transaction and do research about the transaction. I know I myself have been in a store and been unsure about if this is the best price, if there's someplace else in you know, my area that could have this particular item, and I can quickly type in the information about the product and see what else comes up. There are applications, and I haven't used these, but about a third of the people in the survey that the Fed did said they had done this where they scan a barcode on the product to try to find out more information about it. So you could see lots of examples how this might be growing in the future and more applications might be coming into place. And again, this is an area where very few financial education or consumer education products have treaded. So we have some opportunities there as well. All right, so the big issue, I think, where there's a lot of room for all of us to learn more and for financial education in general to address better is the issue of security. You know, if your smartphone becomes your wallet, it allows you to make transactions, to buy and sell, to move money from here to there, and you lose it, that could be detrimental. So thinking about how you secure your smartphone, using passwords on your smartphone, having smart passwords where we don't have the same password for every single one of our accounts. We've learned that a lot in the press in the last couple of weeks as we've had security breaches of various kinds. You know, a lot of consumers are, frankly, kind of lazy. They don't have a plan to become a mobile banking user. They just sort of slowly evolve into it, and as a result, they don't have a plan. They don't have a strategy. They don't have different passwords for different accounts, different usernames for different accounts. And, you know, partly it's because it's hard to manage, but partly it's a lack of planning. And so just like any other aspect of financial management that requires some forethought and, you know, being really intentional about our actions, the same is true on these account management activities. And this is true for a computer, tablet, a mobile device. It's not just strictly in the mobile area. But certainly lots of opportunities that consumers can be smarter about how they engage in these kinds of technologies and keep their information safe. The simplest is password and password management. We are, I think, starting to see more applications that use alternative forms of identification, whether that's fingerprints or retina scans or pictures or different kinds of ways to keep things as safe as possible. But that's going to take a while to implement. And so meanwhile, we have to make sure that people are smart about how they manage their accounts and manage their devices. It should be noted that most institutions want people to use these devices. It saves them money. They don't have to have as many tellers working. They don't have to have as many bricks and mortar branches. So a lot of financial institutions will guarantee any losses that a consumer might have from using their cell phone to deposit a check and if things go wrong. Whether consumers know this or not and how they seek remedy when things do go wrong is an important issue, not one we've seen much discussion about in the financial education area, but certainly one that deserves more attention. It should also be noted that the dumb phone, the really simple phone with text messaging, is probably one of the safest out there. If all I'm really using my cell phone for is balance checking and payment alerts and balance alerts, those kinds of things, and those are set up, say, online or even in a bank branch or on the phone, those text messages that come to me are pretty safe. They're not disclosing any information, really. And so people who are really paranoid about security problems, maybe they should just stick with a traditional text-type phone, but still use the aspects of it that are appropriate for them. All right, so I'll start to wrap up. I can understand if you're still skeptical at this point, because a lot of these tools seem like they're still evolving, and I think that's true. They are still evolving. I think they're evolving probably faster than we all think. But there's an interesting figure here from Frank Magid Associates, which is an online research company, and so they are sort of trying to provide information to people in the industry about where the market's headed. But they've done this forecast, which I think is reasonably it's plausible, let me say that, but up to 80% of all mobile phone users will be, in the smartphone area, and then about two-thirds, about 64%, are going to be using tablets. So we're going to see a lot more use of these tools. So the market penetration is going to go up and up and up. The vast majority now, according to their forecast in 2014, will be on these mobile devices. And I think that says a lot, both for how we do education, for the content of our education. Maybe actually using devices for education might be something to begin to think more about. Even if we don't move to delivering education online and using smartphones as a delivery vehicle, we might use the smartphone in our education. So you can imagine where people come to your workshops and they have their mobile devices with them. Instead of talking about checking account balances, they can do it. Instead of looking at, some self-recall of how they spent their money, they can pull up their account numbers and see their actual data on what they've been spending their money on and where it comes and what their deposits have looked like and what their outflows have looked like. You know, so it becomes much easier to talk about things like spending plans or goals around budgeting when you actually have real data in real time. I think it also, we can think more about how to train people to use their smartphones for just-in-time information. This is sort of a big topic right now at the federal level, is the idea of just-in-time financial education, that people aren't going to learn all the ins and outs of all aspects of finance, particularly in high school, and then remember it 40 years later. But rather, we want to give them tools so that they can figure out information when it's time. And so part of that might mean, you know, teaching people how to use that barcode scanner on their smartphone to look up and see whether that's the best price for a product, or to try to figure out what their account balance is before they make a major purchase, those kinds of things. So, you know, training consumers to develop those skills or maybe habits as they engage in these kinds of major financial decisions in just real time, in the point of purchase or the point of signing a document, that kind of thing. You know, I think there's lots of ways that when people do search, say they're in a store and they search about some particular product, or they're, you know, made a credit offer and they're searching for information, do we have websites? Do we have apps? Do we have other kinds of things that pop up, you know, so that if they're looking for advice and they trust Extension as an objective source of that advice, are we creating information that is mobile device enabled, that can be seen and quickly come up on these kinds of devices? I mean, right now, we don't give that, I don't give that a whole lot of thought, but maybe it's something we should begin to think more about. And then we're going to have people who are going to be sour on these technologies, either because of the technology they have or don't have, or because of past experiences. And so how do we help them, or how do we help people when they get into trouble, when they do have a bad experience, or they do have a security breach, those kinds of things. Obviously, security is a big issue, one that I know many of you already teach about, but there's probably a whole nother set of issues to begin teaching about related to the mobile device and misplacing your mobile device, or breaching your mobile device, that kind of thing. And then finally, I've talked a lot about text messages and the reminders in the past. I again think this is an exciting area, one that, you know, it would be quite easy to do reminders or goal setting with people who come through workshops using text messaging. So it's, again, an area we might just think about how we integrate that more into the kinds of education that we do. So I'll stop there. I've raised a bunch of questions. I don't know if I have answers for all of these, but I would welcome any comments that you all have or other questions that you might have.
I have a question. With the using your phone to purchase things rather than a credit card, do you think that's going to be more secure than, like, the current credit cards we have? That was one of the issues that came up with this whole Target debacle, that, you know, we don't have the most secure systems. We need to switch to something that, like, Europe is using or whatever. How do you think the phones come in terms of that kind of security?
They could be more secure. I think the way they're mostly used right now isn't any more secure. So, The problem with the way that, so the Target situation was that these dumb cards that we have with these magnetic strips, anybody can swipe it, and that magnetic strip doesn't change over time. So there's no dynamic switching. So in Europe, they have these little chips in the cards, and so that little chip has like a different algorithm, so that every time it swipes, it generates a different code, and the machine on the other side has to match that to make sure this is really the right card. It's not a like stolen strip or something like that. So it has a little more security into it. And so cell phones could do that, but currently many of the scanning devices you see in a store where, you know, you might see somebody dip their cell phone into the little red thing to make a purchase, doesn't have any of that dynamic stuff to it. So it's really just as dumb as a cell phone, or I'm sorry, as a credit card. So it doesn't really solve the problem right now, but certainly it could going forward. And you could imagine where, you know, you might have an application on your cell phone that has to recognize you, your face, your fingerprint or something before that actual purchase goes through. So there's a lot of room for growth in that area for sure.
Michael, this is Karen Anadagimi, and I'm wondering if you've seen any psychological articles of how people reason of what to buy and what not to buy. I remember the story of a lady that was in the Get Checking class, and she just thought, you know, she had more checks, so she kept writing more checks. And she didn't have money in the account, so that's why she ended up with a checking class. How are we helping people make decisions and thinking through what resources they have and what they want, how they're spending their money?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, when you talk about a cell phone or a prepaid card, those kinds of things, it's, you know, the same thing. You can keep using it until it's gone, but that doesn't mean the money's there. I mean, one of the nice things about these, both the cards and the use of the phones, is there is a feedback loop. So it's almost like when you write that check, you know, a hand grabs you and says, hey, you don't have enough money for that check to cash. So it does have a feedback loop, which is nice. I think the other thing which is underused is you can actually track your spending in real time. So either by category or by day or by week, you can see when the money's going out and when it's coming in. And that can be a really powerful tool to somebody to say, hey, every Friday I'm spending a ton of money. What's going on? So, you know, there are some nice analytic tools that I think we probably underuse right now.
Michael, this is Chris Kniepen. Are there some apps, specific ones, that you would recommend or have people stay away from for those tasks?
You know, there are a lot of apps out there, and that's part of the problem.
Right.
If you, like, on the iPhone or on the Android, whatever they call it, market, you'll just find hundreds and hundreds of these apps. And my suggestion on these is start with your own financial institution. You know, if they offer an app, oftentimes it does most of what you want, and, you know, that's a good place to start. Rather than going to a third party, stick to something in-house. Among the third party ones, I think the ones that are from, you know, more reputable providers or, where you have just, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of users are probably going to be safer than the ones where you have just a handful of users. Those seem kind of sketchy.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I can't say that there's one out there or even a handful out there that I think are great. I mean, I think, my credit union has a pretty good one and I intend to use that one. So that's probably the place to start for most people is wherever they have their account.
Is that a larger credit union you're connected to?
It is, although most of them are moving to online platforms of different kinds.
I know the credit union I'm a part of I do online banking with them, but that's a pretty small, so I haven't checked that part out yet.
Yeah, I think credit unions have been slower, for sure.
Michael, this is Lori Zero from Pierce County. When we teach our college transition classes, one of the things that's pretty common for most parents when we talk about what worries them most about sending their children off, it's the personal finance piece of it. And we used to, you know, have personal finance classes in high school that taught kids how to balance a checkbook. Well, now kids are just automatically given debit cards to start with, and they really haven't learned the concept of checking, you know, subtracting, making sure that balance is there. And now I think most people just assume that the bank is always right. So how can we help them understand that you need to check, you know, maybe keep receipts to check and make sure that you're not getting charged things you didn't buy? That seems to be a big issue with these folks.
Yeah, I mean, most people who are signing up at a financial institution today for a transaction account are not getting checks.
Right.
They don't get them. They don't order them. They don't get them. They don't use them. And, I mean, this is where a debit card in tandem with a cell phone can actually be useful, because what you can do is set it up. I mean, this is the thing, you have to set it up, and so a lot of consumers fail to do this, and they don't take advantage of the features. But even if you just have a dumb phone, you can have it text you every time you make a swipe, and that text tells you the amount of the swipe. So you can, in real time, say, hey, I just got a text, it's $12.50, hey, look, the receipt or whatever, the cash register here says, you know, some other amount, $9.50, you know, they charge me more. So there's that. Plus, it can do the balance checking. And you can set it up so that it emails you every day or every week and tells you what the current balance is, or that that email is triggered by a balance above or below some amount. So the, you know, in some ways the phone, the technological device can become a way to do these things that people were doing with their check register before.
Michael, this is Christy. Just a question for you on the text messaging piece. Are any of the financials moving towards kind of making that the default, that when you open a new account, you set up these text message alerts kind of right away, or is it something that you have to remember to go in and sign up later? I know in some of the teaching that I've done, I've not gotten the sense that people really know about that or are taking advantage of it, even though it seems like it could be a really helpful early warning sign with your, you know, balance getting low or some of the uses that you've just described.
It's always opt-in, and I'm not an attorney, and I don't understand bank regulation, but from what I've been told by my colleagues in the financial institutions is that they don't perceive that they're allowed to automatically do this because they don't, first of all, they don't often get your text message or your cell phone number, and then if they do, they don't have your permission to do this. So you have to affirmatively ask for it in order for it to be set up. I think that's changing a little bit, like different regulators have different viewpoints on this, particularly when it comes to, you know, like paying credit obligations. You know, it seems like everyone's best interest is in you remembering to do that. So I think that's changing, but right now it's opt-in, and it's because of this perception of what regulators want the financial institution to do. Other questions or comments? I appreciate everybody chiming in today. This is, we don't always get as much discussion as today, so I appreciate it.
I thought it was interesting. The other day I was at some store and I purchased something and they asked for my email account and I said, no, I don't want to give you my email account. And they said, well, we aren't going to be issuing paper receipts much longer, so at some point you'll have to give us your email account. So, and I was at another store the other day, and they also said, they asked you if they can send you the receipt electronically because they're starting to go paperless.
Yeah. Yeah, it's more and more, so they would track you by your credit card number or, you know, by your phone number or your email, something else, so that's less and less of these paper receipts.
Mm-hmm. This is Joanne. Brain and think right. I just wanted to make a few comments. I have to affirm that the people that I'm working with financial coaching, who are definitely low income, most of them do have a smartphone. And when we're doing a coaching session and they want to check what a bill payment was, they just go online or go and check their phone and they find it. So I was actually surprised because I have a dumb phone, so it's been interesting watching them. The second thing, and I don't think this is going to be a long-term thing, but one of the Twin Cities TV stations has done a little survey since the Target security breach, and they are finding that more people are using cash now than they used to.
Mm.
But I think my opinion is that's probably going to be temporary because it's going to be a bigger hassle to always have cash.
Yeah, I hadn't seen that, but I can believe that. I mean, we've done some interviews with people who have gotten fed up and they've just sort of dropped off the financial system and tried to handle cash. But there's a limit to that. I mean, once you start to have a lot of cash, it's like, you know, where do you keep it? And, you know, if you ever did have to worry about inflation, it just becomes sort of unfeasible at some level.
And there's risk, too, in losing it.
Oh, yeah, you can get robbed, yeah, or lose it. All right, well, you know, I really appreciate everybody's time today. I'm glad this topic was of interest. We can also get more information from the Fed, so if there are further questions you had, you know, Max actually was willing to be on the call today, but then he realized it's a holiday, federal holiday, so they were closed. But I think there are some opportunities in the future to, you know, engage them about, you know, digging deeper into certain populations in their data, or they're going to do another version of the survey in the future, so I think they'd be open to ideas that we might have for future questions as well. So our next call, Lunchtime Learning call, is on March 17th, and we're going to talk about emergency savings. I don't like the term emergency savings, so I may change the name of it before the next call, because it's really about people having a small amount of money to make ends meet when they need it, whether that's because they have an income shortfall or an unexpected expense, or they have an opportunity, something that they can take advantage of if they just have some cash, and how do they do that? So that this call will be summarizing about a year's worth of work we've been doing with the Mott Foundation about different strategies for emergency savings or contingency savings, you might think about it that way. We just have two more calls after that. One will be in April on improving credit scores and strategies for financial educators in that. And then our May call is sort of our, I think we've done this the last couple of years, is summer reading suggestions. And I actually welcome any time if you come across a book that you think is new and out there and good for other financial educators to read, let me know, because we'll want to share those with your colleagues, because you know, I know you have nothing to do over the summer except for read books. So this will be an opportunity to kick off the summer with our reading list. So thanks, everybody, and have a great snowy week.